This is Peter Bishop, Vegetable World and Depth Psychology, June 2nd, 1995.
The hemispheres isn't very good for the vegetable soul. It upsets the digestion and the seasons change, and so when I left it was winter, but it was a beautiful day, but cold. And I arrive here and it's hot. Well, warm, it's nice, nice day. Okay, when the Dalai Lama came to Australia recently, I was asked to give a few radio talks about why was Tibet so fascinating for Westerners, and I pointed out, basically drawing on some of that earlier work that I'd done, Myth of Shangri-La, that there's been a long history of fascination, and partly it was due to the fact that Tibet was on the roof of the world, and so it's the highest mountain and the highest country in the world, and the rivers, most of the great rivers of... Can we just turn that down slightly? I've got a jangly. That's it. That's great. Yeah, thanks. And most of the great rivers of Asia come from Tibet. You know, they start up there, the Brahmaputra, the Ganges, and the Yellow River, and so on. And there was a kind of, certainly in the last century, there was a fascination with the notion of the source of rivers, the source of mysticism, and even the idea of the source of the Aryan race, which seemed to come out of Central Asia, so primal vitality and so on. Okay, so I said all of this, and then a few days later I got a letter in the post from someone who wrote to me and said, what difference does it make that there's a few lousy rivers in Tibet? And they also enclosed a little booklet which was called The Inner Self Located. And it was about Hindu meditation, and it said that the inner self was located in the brain stem. And I felt really sad, a bit sad and a bit outraged by this, because I thought, well, there's millions of Hindus who worship these rivers, these lousy rivers, as goddess and goddesses. And the idea of collapsing consciousness simply into the brain stem seemed to me to be a little bit outrageous. And I thought, well, no wonder we're in the middle of an environmental catastrophe when the animation of nature has been stripped from that and simply located in some small part of the brain. And I thought, well, if Mount Everest and the Himalayas and these great rivers are not thought of as sacred, what chance do we have with potatoes and carrots? In fact, Jung wrote that we've actually stripped the nature of soulful animation, and we've lost a world that used to, as he says, pulse with our blood and breathe with our breath. It's become more and more collapsed, so that the normal idea, if you like, is that, well, who I am is in here somehow. In fact, not just in here, it's up here. You know, it's around, well, it's on the brainstem, wherever that is, in here. And everything out there, apart from you, is unconscious, is inanimate. So basically, it's like we're walking around in a cemetery. There's just these little isolated bits of consciousness that beam it out. And he pointed out in... Jung wrote favourably that the alchemists believe that the greater part of soul lies outside the body. And I think that's... And he called this the world soul. So in fact, our individual soul is just a small part of this entity called the world soul, anima mundi. And of course... This relates to the talk tonight, which is about plants and about reality. And I really wanted to have a potato and a cabbage and something here, you see. And a colleague of mine at the University of New York in Buffalo wrote a nice paper about children and environmental education. And the paper's called Where Did You Go, the Forest, and What Did You See? Nothing. And it was about some kids who were going out on a nature walk in the forest. And when they came back, the teacher said, Where did you go? And they said, The forest. And they said, What did you see? Nothing. And it was as if the vegetation, the trees, were merely a background. And I think we often live like that. You know, Paul and I were talking about the grass as we were driving here. And it's like the grass is this invisible carpet. We tend to very easily think of vegetation as being nothing, unless it's beautiful flowers, of course, and so on. So I'm here tonight to talk about potatoes and cabbages, both the soul of the potato and also the potato of our soul. Its potato-ness. Now, it might seem strange to talk about the soul, the poem, or the divinity of the potato. And I really like the way it brings up a chuckle, because I actually feel that there's a real humour and wit about vegetables. We only have to think of the pumpkin at Halloween. That's a sort of dark or rhubarb, which seems to be a laxative, you know, and break up kind of intellectual constipation. And beans, you know, all the jokes about beans and wind and so on. So there's a kind of a gustoso humour about vegetables. But the fact is that when vegetables were invented by the Incas... They were worshipped as a god. The potato was worshipped as a god. And in Aboriginal Australia, they have the sacred yam dreaming and sacred yam dance. And yam is like a sweet potato. And, I mean, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with corn and the place of corn within certainly in the southwest and in Mexico as a divinity. No ceremony would be undertaken without corn. So the potatoes is a bit like that. In the Himalayas, I've obviously done quite a lot of work in the Himalayas, and certainly among Sherpas in the Himalayas, the potato is a very revered article. It's their basic kind of bread of life. And the Irish, we only have to think of the potato in the memoria of the Irish, the potato famine and blight, and the place of the potato in that kind of cultural memory. Or, I mean, other plants would be among black populations with plantation crops. Again, they would resonate with this sort of very dark sort of underworld almost memory. When the potato, I'm just going to talk about the potato for a little bit here. When the potato was first brought over from America to the old world, the Puritans refused to eat it because it wasn't mentioned in the Bible. So it didn't have legitimacy. And the Scots, there was a sort of famine on at the time in Scotland, and one of the lords insisted that the people ate the potato. And they refused, but he forced them to grow the potatoes, and when they had them, they actually dumped the potatoes at his door rather than eat them. They'd rather starve than eat them. And when the potato first came to Britain, because it was the sweet potato, they thought of it as an aphrodisiac. I'm not quite sure. It's the knobbly, longitudinal. But anyway. So I kind of think, well, there's other ways we can start to reimagine the potato. I think of the potato as a kind of the great mother potato, which is the sort of basic, solid food of the family. Or there's the Ares potato that the army marches on. You know, the army always marches on its stomach, and the idea of peeling potatoes and so on. Or there's the Hermes potato, which is fast food, chips, you know, always on the move and so on. And, I mean, everyone eats, but chips is like the major vegetable of the modern Western world. And even the Hercules potato, which is, someone once wrote that the potato was crucial for the Industrial Revolution because it's a lot of protein, it can be grown in the backyards and so on, so you've got the muscle power there. So we can start to imagine this. And the reason I start with, although we're talking about the vegetable soul, I start with vegetables like that because, one, is they're slightly ridiculous, but two, is because there's so much literature around flowers and the spirituality of flowers or the spirituality of trees that we can easily kind of short-circuit, if you like, the hard work that needs to be done to start to reclaim weeds and grass, and I think the potatoes and vegetables that we eat every day. We handle them. We go into the supermarket. We deal with these. And they're part of our world more, if you like, than many flowers are. We actually take them inside of us, which we don't do with many flowers, although there's a couple of nice flowers we eat. So we have to work at this a little bit. The other thing about the vegetable soul is that it's been called by one Jungian analyst the vitality at the very depth of the archetype. So we have to think of the vegetable world as being this kind of layer of uncanny depth which provides us with life and energy. And in fact, the word vegetable, of course, is often used in a negative way. People talk about someone vegetating, or if somebody's had in a coma or paralyzed, they talk about them being, they're nothing but a vegetable. Or if somebody likes to watch television, they're a couch potato. What else is there? People just vegetating, living a humdrum life, lacking mobility, lacking intellectual consciousness and so on. So it's very negative. But the word itself comes from vigere, which means vigilant, vigor, energy, being wide awake and so on. So that often in the literature we encounter this double side. On the one side there's a fear of vegetables, a fear of vegetating, of just becoming a vegetable. And I think that's to do with a fear of death, a fear of immobility, of the downward regions of soul, if you like, of depression. And at the same time, though, there's this notion of an enormous sort of fertility and fecundity and energy of the vegetable world. There was a lovely saying in John Donne's time. There was one poet who talked about a woman as being really kind of beautiful and so on, and vegetal. And what he meant was fertile and alive and a really kind of ripe vegetable. We don't use that term very much. Now, one of the main casualties of our society has not only been the ecology outside, but also the ecological imagination. That is, the animals and plants within our dreams. And if we don't take care of the animals and vegetables and plants in our dreams, then we're not going to take care of them outside. We're going to have a very strange sort of relationship. In Aboriginal Australian culture, traditional culture, they had an event called the Increase Ceremony. And what they would do would they go to a particular sacred site and they would perform various dances, rituals, tell stories and so on. And they actually believe, part of the Aboriginal cosmology, is they actually believe that if they don't do these dances and tell these stories and sing these songs at these places, then the animals and plants will die. Now, of course, people think, well, look, surely they know that if they don't do it one year and the plants still come up, then they'd think scientifically there's a causal something wrong here. But of course they will die. They'll die as bearers of soul. And in a sense, if they don't do the ceremonies, then the plants will die. They won't carry soul or imagination. And then who cares what happens to them? It's like as soon as trees cease to be bearers of soul or fantasy, then it doesn't really matter. We can chop them down and it's fine, you know. There's a dream which I'll just mention briefly, where a man and a woman, they're both very beautiful, beautiful people, and they ride out to a hill to inspect a tree on a hill. And when they get there, they cut the tree to check the sap. And the sap sprays out of the tree. And they think, oh, this is wonderful. And the woman goes under the sap, and sort of it's like a spray over in a fountain. And the man joins in too. But then all of a sudden, their skin starts to wrinkle and deform, and fungus starts to grow on their faces. And I can't help thinking here that what this dream is about is that we often think that, or generally people think, that the return to nature will be really beautiful. But nature isn't necessarily there to sustain our way of life and what we think. And I think that often, you know, the return to nature will challenge many of our fondest beliefs and our ideas about the body beautiful, and so on. So I kind of think this dream is a return to nature, but it may be not quite the return to nature that people wanted. This dream, and I wanted to just to mention this dream, which in some ways was the founding dream that began my kind of vegetable quest. I was working on a dream of a friend who was a 30-year-old woman who was... She dreamt she was in prison and feeling very helpless, and it felt as though she was underground with long kind of tunnels, like going underground. And then all of a sudden, she was in a prisoner of war camp, and there were these soldiers lying around, dressed in army greys and greens and very drab sort of colours, and they're all lying listless around the place. And then she noticed that their heads were cabbages, had turned into cabbages. Now, when I first heard this dream, my immediate response was that she had a fear of being turning into a cabbage, that she had a fear of being paralyzed, of being immobile, of lacking will, you know. So one would want to say, hey, you've got to get out there and do it and all the rest of it. But I kind of suddenly caught myself, because there's been a revisioning, for example, of the notion of animal in the last 10 years. I mean, when people had animal dreams, the word animal was a negative. You animal, meaning violent, raw, and not being controlled, uncivilized. So I kind of thought, well, maybe, hang on a minute, maybe if we have these vegetables in our dreams, maybe I'm being a bit rough on the vegetable to think that, you know, just the standard cabbage interpretation that I'm sure you would all know about, you know, well, you're afraid of being a cabbage, and being a cabbage is like being in a prisoner of war camp. You see what I mean? And you're trapped there. And I thought, well, maybe it's not her that was trapped. Maybe it's the cabbage that's trapped in a concentration camp of our interpretation. And I kind of thought, well, maybe what is happening here is that the martial or heroic spirit is being immobilized by the vegetable. It's stopping it. It's calling it back to say, hang on a minute, you're trapped, you can't go anywhere, you can't do your heroics, you've got to stay where you are. And it's like the head, which many of us get trapped in our culture quite easily, becomes turned into a vegetable. It's an alchemical transformation. I felt it was a really great image and of this sort of transformation into taking care of her vegetable, her cabbage. And in fact, there's a number of dreams. There's another dream that came up from a man this time, where he's got a big kind of cauldron of soup and he's stirring the cauldron soup. And when he looks in there, instead of there being a cabbage in there, there's a head, a human head. And he's kind of stirring up this kind of this cabbage. And people come along and have a look inside and they get a bit nauseous at this, you know. But I felt there, that's a really lovely image too of working in a vegetable way, because you're not going in a linear direction, you're stirring the pot. And I can't, you can play with the words, like I felt that he was getting ahead, you know? But he was getting ahead by cooking, by going around, by stirring up the juices. It's like the stomach, you know, the cauldron. And he was stirring here and cooking, and there was this sense of an alchemical sort of shift. The other thing is, in a lot of fairy stories, there are vegetables and wounded soldiers. I've come across lots of that, where the soldier is rejected by the army or by the king and ends up becoming like a gardener, or finding himself in a garden or down a deep well or something like this. And I think it's quite an interesting conjunction. This, you know, in the past, most soldiers of the world were peasants who were then recruited into the army. And then when their time in the army was finished, they went back to being peasants again. So there's this kind of historical connection between soldiers and vegetables. The other thing, of course, is that Jung pointed out that in many traditions, this notion of immobility, which I'm going to kind of work on a bit, this notion of immobility, of cutting out kind of intellectual thought, is also similar to yoga and meditation in Eastern traditions, where you immobilize, you darken the room, you sit quietly for days, or if you're in Tibetan retreat for 3 years, 3 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days. And you can't, that's called vegetating. It makes a couch potato look active. So there's this notion of an incredible stillness and a watching. And Jung pointed out that in many cultures, in many mythologies, the image of the plant or the vegetable is a symbol of spirituality. And what we have then is an axis, a vertical axis, where on one level the vegetable takes us down into the roots. You know, we use word roots. Well, roots are what vegetable and plants have. So it takes us deep, deep down into the earth, and it transforms the inanimate world of soil and matter into life. And Jung pointed out the miracle of plants is that they actually transform inanimate life, inanimate substance, into life. And anything else lives on that. I mean, no animal can live without plants. And so it's an extraordinary transformation to move from what we would call non-life into life. And that is thought of in terms of being placed. I mean, if you're a vegetable or a plant, that's your place for life. You just stay there. You're in a pot, of course. But you're there, and you draw sustenance from this spot, and your roots go down. And at the same time, it's on the vertical part of this axis. It's imagined to be the direct route to the spirit. So Shiva, for example, is imagined in Kundalini Yoga to be the base of the lower chakra, the base of the spine or the central kind of column, and he's imagined to be green, like a kind of a green womb waiting to be born. And Jung also wrote about the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit being green, because it's full of life, full of beginning and fertility and so on. So we've got these two directions. So what I did was, you know, having realized that I was being not bad to the cabbage, being very reductive, I set out on a quest, and I came across the idea, the ancient idea of the vegetable soul. I wondered four questions, really. One was, what did our ancestors mean by the vegetable soul? The second one was what happened to it? Why did we lose it? Why did we lose this idea? And then, well, what value does the vegetable soul have now, the idea of the vegetable soul? And finally, it was, how can we listen to and dialogue and work with this vegetal sort of world? And I came across probably the most famous comments about this were in a book by Burton called The Anatomy of Melancholy, which was a Renaissance classic. And what he did, and you can find the idea of the vegetable soul going back to ancient Greece, and you find it in North African, in Islamic culture and so on. And the idea was that there were three souls, or three parts to the same soul, depends. And humans had all three. That was what they called the rational soul, that is what we now call thinking, cognition. And then there was the sensible soul, which was what we might call now instincts. And it was the animal part of us. And then there was the vegetal soul, or the vegetable soul. And what the ancients and the Renaissance people believed was that plants have the vegetable soul, that animals have the sensible soul and the vegetable soul, and that humans have the rational soul, the sensible soul, and the vegetable soul. So we have all three. Okay, so it's kind of important. Now, the rational soul was about thinking and cognition and those kind of function, those types of things. And the sensible soul was the what we now call the animal. And the vegetal soul was connected to things like reproductive system, to digestion in the body, this is, to these sorts of emotions. What we would now call the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, or the autonomic nervous system. That is, the beating of the heart, the reproductive systems, the control of the bladder and excretion, these types of issues. And it's very important that, because what happened was, is here we had a metaphor which included everything from real plants and trees to these sorts of functioning within us that was so deep that conscious mind couldn't contact it. You know, the autonomic nervous system by its very nature, unless one did very special yogic exercises and hence could control the heartbeat. You know, in India, people can do these, if you're a yogic practitioner, they can bury you alive. You know, you can stop all this. But basically, the autonomic nervous system is beyond our conscious functioning. So when we get scared, we want to defecate, you know, and that's beyond us. Or we want to control our temperature range and so on. And through certain kinds of meditative, relaxive sort of exercises, we can introduce a measure of control. But fundamentally, this was part of our anatomy that was fundamental but beyond rational control. And it seems to me that if we wanted to get into a historical thing here, that you've got the Age of Enlightenment, or the Age of Reason, which of course was in the kind of particularly the 18th century, was the time when the rational soul, what we now call cognition, had its heyday. It was all about reason and about rationality and so on, and enlightenment in that way. But then with Darwin and psychoanalysis, we start to get attention being paid to instincts, to the animal. And you find that certainly through Darwin, who wrote, of course, that our ancestors were apes, suddenly people thought, my God, we're connected to the animals. We are animal. Through psychoanalysis, including Jung, we start to have to take into account the notion that the reason and rationality is a small tip of the iceberg, that we have this instinctuality that is very much part of the animal world. And of course, through people like Joseph Campbell and recent work, we start to respect the animal in a different way. It's not just instinct as being something that's out of control, but through shamanism, people try to connect with their animal, and we try to value the animal part of us, and so on. I'm sure you're all familiar with this in American Indian ritual or in terms of that. But what people seem to forget is that Darwin didn't just say our ancestors were apes. He said our ancestors were plants. He said that our ancestors were algae. So, and I don't think that quite got through in the 19th century, you see. And there's a lot of interesting scientific parallels. For example, the chlorophyll in sap, the green, has the same structure as in hemoglobin in blood. And the way plants turn to the sun is due to a light sensitive cells, which is of course what our eyes are. And in fact, there are many, many parallels to do, if you wanted to be scientific, that is, to do with the fact that biologically we are connected to plants. And I'm sure when you see people lying around on couches, we think, well, they are too. But
So what I would like to propose is that with the environment, and I think that in the 20th century, where we've actually started to value animals a lot more, there's been a move against zoos. We feel that we're aware of animals becoming extinct, and that our animal part needs to be trusted, and so on. I feel that we've moved to the next phase, which is the vegetable part, the vegetal world. The concern, for example, about the Amazon rainforest, the fact that we need these forests, not just for us, but to support the atmosphere, you know, the ozone layer, to basically plant life. Every time a supertanker goes down, we destroy so much algae in the water, and that means that the photosynthesis isn't going on. And so on. And I think that people are becoming more and more aware that in terms of environmentalism, it's the plant world we need to look at, even to things like monoagriculture, to the use of pesticides. The latest thing, of course, is these viral things that are coming out of the tropical rainforests, like Ebola. I don't know if people here, I'm sure. You know, as we move into the... It's almost like a vegetable revenge. As we move in and chop these things down, which we thought we could do, suddenly we're finding that we're disturbing these other kinds of habitats. I always think in films too and books, we've got The Day of the Triffids. I don't know if people remember The Day of the Triffids. But there was also the... What was that one? That's the one, yeah. Was it in? Invasion. I was kept thinking of revenge. Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Another one there with, again, these kind of pods and people becoming vegetables, you know, losing their will and so on. So there's a whole thing I discovered in literature about the revenge of the vegetable. We could point to smoking, to alcoholism. They all come from vegetables too. Tobacco used to be the most widely smoked plant, widely used drug in North America, or in the whole of America, from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego. But it was always used in a sacred way. And people called addiction was called... No, because people knew you became... Something happened to you. They said that addiction was merely serving the god. Each shaman had their own special kind of powerful tobacco that they would grow and cultivate themselves. Now, we don't call that. We call it addiction. And, you know, we don't say people are addicted to Christ. You see what I mean? In other words, what we've done is to take a certain kind of vegetable power and we've turned it into a profane experience, and it's out of control. In the same way that alcohol was always part of a Dionysian sort of ritual. So I can't help that, and drugs too. I mean, cocaine, all this stuff, all starts from the vegetable world. Even plastic actually comes from the vegetable, from oils, which are trees and so on. So I kind of think that what's happening, and that I think the next century will be, is about the vegetable world. Now, what does that mean in terms of us personally? Well, I think one of the great crises in our time is about place and about dwelling, about having a home, having roots and so on. I think this is why you find this enormous concern about one's ancestors. You know, people looking up trees and where did I come from? And there's all these debates about adoption. And even there's a syndrome, oh, I love syndromes, called the genealogical distress syndrome. Do you know this one? The genealogical distress syndrome. Now, what this is about not knowing who your biological parents were. And it's actually gone down to the idea of sperm donors. And in fact, I think it was in America, but it might not be, where there was one guy I saw on television, and he was saying the reason he has depression and he feels bad about everything and is a failure is because he didn't know who the sperm donor was. And in fact, they've made it law now that sperm donors are basically have to be known publicly. You know, you can find out who your donor was. And there was one guy who was interviewed, he said, look, you know, I give my sperm freely, but the last thing I want is kind of 300 kids knocking on the door calling me daddy. In fact, it got quite strange because in Germany they were doing these experiments using the eggs from female fetuses that had died in for whatever reason in the womb, and they were using these eggs as part of the program. And people said, my God, imagine what genealogical distress you had if you found out that your mother was never actually born, that she was a corpse, a fetal corpse. So I'm just saying, this is the kind of syndrome. So what we're finding is that we live in a society that's manically mobile. You know, people change and so on. And so one of the major issues is to do with place, and Paul was talking about nostalgia, and nostalgia is this longing for a place and a longing for roots. And Jung, actually, even in the 1930s, talked about this disease which is running through the West. This is the 1930s. People are too restless. They need a place where they can put down roots. Now, obviously, we're going to have to work on that and be a little bit more Hermes on this one. But the idea is there that somehow we have a kind of place-related distress. And in Australia, this is exaggerated, because what you've got is a culture that's the oldest place-related culture in the world. The Aborigines have been living on that continent for between 40 to 50,000 years. They're the longest civilization has ever been in one place, whereas white Australia is the newest. It's only been there for about say 200 years. So you've got this enormous gap between one culture which is sort of new to the place and another one which has been there so long that it's almost impossible to comprehend. Now, in the going back to the that was a sidetrack. Where am I? In the vegetable soul. What was it about? Well, one of the most important characteristics of the vegetable soul in the Renaissance was to do with digestion, and I can't help thinking that when we think of stress and ulcers and the whole lifestyle we're living, instead of thinking about stress, which is a term that was only invented coming out of the age of metallurgy and the Industrial Revolution, you know, the metaphor of metal, it's much better, I think, to think about the fact that we're not paying heed to the vegetable soul. That in the Renaissance we find people talking about digestion and placing an emphasis, and digestion needs a slow pace and a rhythm. And what they meant by digestion was four things. One was the ability to attract nourishment. You either kind of reached it and put it in, or you attracted it kind of in an imaginal way, like soul food. So, and a plant has to do that, you know. A plant does it by attracting insects, you know, down it goes, because it can't move. So it has to attract it, you see. So, or it draws in the nourishment from leaves or from its roots. So the first phase of digestion is getting the soul food. The second phase is to be able to hold it and to provide a container. The third phase is then breaking it down, extracting the goodness. And the fourth phase is then getting rid of the waste product. And it seems to me, I mean, in the work that I've done with myself and with other people, is you find that some people are terrific at attracting the soul food, but it goes straight through the system. It doesn't have time. They can't hold it. You know, they're full of ideas. You know, I mean, it's something I have a problem with. That. You know, ideas come and then you're on to the next idea and the next idea and so on and so forth. And before, it just goes straight through the system. And now other people are great, not so good at that, but they're great at providing a vessel for it, but they're constantly waiting for something to come into it. And other people are lousy at digesting it, you know, or some people are good at digesting, but they don't want to get rid of it. You know, and we all have that problem too. We spend a great time walking around late talking about piles. What do we do with our junk of waste? You know, we move them around and we have to have little junk sites around the place. But, you know, it seems to me that a fully functioning vegetal sort of life is the ability to have soul nourishment, either through stories. I mean, the other thing, and here I go again on another one, the word digestion comes from the root meaning jest. And jest, of course, means story. So beau geste is a story, but it also means gesture as well. And so storytelling is a part of digesting. You know, we mull over things with a story and so on. So I kind of feel it's a way of working with images too. It's a way of looking at our lives, that somehow we've got to make sure there's enough nourishment coming in. We have to provide a vessel which can hold it for long enough so that we can extract some goodness out of it. But then we've got to let it go. And a lot of people have trouble letting it go. I know when I'm teaching meditation, some people are terrific at starting off, but they hate closing it down. You know, they hate, if they're into a really good state, they don't want to say that's the end of the meditation. You know, they hang on to it. So we've got these are the four sort of moves. And we mustn't think of the immobility or digestion as being literal. I mean, you can go for nice digestive walks, particularly in this garden. Ficino, who was the Renaissance philosopher who was the mentor to the Medicis. And he said that it's really good to go for a nice walk, a gentle walk. So it's not aerobic movement. Okay, so you don't go for an aerobic workout. It's a digestive walk. Taking it in, you know, you're taking in the scenery, you're digesting it, digesting the ideas and taking in the place. So it's a bit like a stroll around the garden. So I think we should actually move to that more. I mean, I like running myself, but I mean, that's not the same. You know, you're moving through space really quickly, and I think we ought to cultivate. In Buddhism, they have walking meditation, and that's slow. That's very slow. Has anyone done walking meditation? It's very slow. Lifting my heel, lifting the foot, balance to the left, putting down the heel, moving thing. It's very slow. You don't move very fast. You have a little space and you just sort of walk backwards and forwards very slowly. So I kind of think it'd be nice to move into this state. So with the vegetable soul, we can move into a number of directions. This is what I'm saying. And I don't know, one of the problems is because I don't know you, I'm not sure which direction we want to go. So, you know, in the workshop tomorrow, we can go in whatever direction people want to go. That's the joy of it. And as Paul said, we'll have a lot of it outside if the weather's very nice. But you can move in a number of directions. I mean, one is to do with the body, our body. You know, so it's to do with our digestive systems, to do with our nervous systems and so on, the autonomic nervous system. I've had people interested in these ideas, for example, who were studying, who had suffered multiple sclerosis, to do with nervous wasting disorders, how to imagine this part of the body, or things to do with stomach or gut disorders, and things like that. So we can look at it that way, or we can use it as a kind of about an imaginal sense, about our dreams, our vegetables and plants and things in dreams. Or you can move into our sense of place. I've lived my home is, my parents are in the mid-80s. That's one of the reasons I'm going to England. They're very vegetable. My dad is probably the most vegetable person I know. To say that he's not mobile assumes that mobility is part of his vocabulary. He's a wonderful man. He's very calm. He's very, very calm. So he's 86, and the thing he enjoys most is digging. He loves digging potatoes in the ground. So last year, he fell off the roof. And I said, what are you doing on the roof? You're 84. What are you doing on the roof? Anyway, the thing about all this is that the place I go to when I go back to England, which I've been in Australia for 25 years, but when I go back to England, it's the home that they live in. They've been there, it's their 60th wedding anniversary, but they've been living in this, my mother has anyway, in this house since about 1915. And it's rented. That's what I love about it. It's just a rented house. And they've just been there. I was born in the house, so when I go back, this is where I entered the world, you know, right here at this spot. And I was there till I was about 17 or 18, and then I just popped out like the spirit out of the alchemical vessel. And I think I've been, ever since then, I think my average span in one home is about 9 months. And that's over quite a period of time. I'm heading for a record at the moment, which is about 3 years in one place. Maybe that's why I got into all this stuff, you know? But I have a capacity to, wherever I am, to feel at home. And I think you have to. And I always think of in North Africa, it's the origin of carpets. You know, the carpet was created by nomads because they take their carpet with them, and wherever they stop, out comes the carpet. That's home. That's their axis mundi. And often in carpets, they have a tree of life motif, and their prayers go on in the carpet, or they put the carpet down in the tent. That's it. So I think we've got to have a kind of carpet mentality if you're mobile, which I'm sure many of us are. So wherever you are, you take your carpet and your things, and that's home. So nomads have a sense of being at home, and maybe I'm a bit of an urban nomad. Anyway, so that's why I'm... So we can talk about place, or we can talk about vegetables in the world. The fact that in Neolithic times, which is about 10,000 years ago, our ancestors used to eat thousands and thousands of types of food, whereas we literally only eat hundreds. I mean, if you go back to the potatoes, the Incas, who invented the potato, had something like 30,000 types of potato for all different conditions, and some of them would grow in very... I think we live on about 30 types. And there are many... there's a kind of high-altitude potato research station up in the Andes that was actually bombed and by the Maoist guerrillas, you know, the shining light guerrillas, which I thought was a terrible thing to do. But there, they kind of there's all these potato types that are still in existence. And of course, what we do is we grow one or two, and then a potato blight comes and wipes out the whole crop. And so we could move into that area. You know, it's illegal in Europe to grow a seed type that hasn't, and then sell it, that hasn't been patented. And you'll find that most seed types of vegetables and plants have been patented by multinational corporations. So we have to start to worry. And people have set up a seed bank where they keep seeds, all these different varieties, in deep freeze, like a kind of chirogenics sort of thing. So that when suddenly there's this kind of emerging out of the rainforest, there's something that destroys all of our potatoes and people can't get chips. What would people do at hamburger shops when we can't eat potato chips? Well, these people will go to the deep freeze, take out the potato seeds, and we'll have new types of potatoes. So we could move in that direction. There's so many directions we could move into. Okay, we've talked about that. Okay, so my quest was a fascinating one. I moved around the world looking for vegetables, and I went to the north of Scotland because I was interested in grain and the peat bogs, and I'd go into supermarkets and look up. And then another thing I did is I went to art galleries, and I started to think, well, where are the vegetables in paintings? And it was great. It was a really good reason to go to art galleries. I'd look at a picture, and is there any vegetables? You know, you walk through, and you suddenly think, what's that? And you look down, and so on, and you find these, and I collected all these vegetable pictures. So I thought I'd show a few now, yeah? We have a few. It's just a handful of vegetable pictures. If I can find it, yeah. Okay. it's not, yep. This one I really like. How green are you? And this, of course, has become a game now, whether you're light green or dark green. You know, if you're a deep ecologist, then you're dark green. You see, light green just simply means that you probably buy tuna that is dolphin safe. And there's this kind of category. So is this whole notion that some... So I partly showed it for that, how the notion of greenness has become appropriated even by the nuclear power industry, you see. And so you find this kind of, well, I'm a bit of a kind of olive green or avocado green. And the thing here is that at the beginning of my book, I wanted to expose this idea that being green is just very simple. You know, green was associated with death among the Irish and the little folk. Green can mean that you're raw and naive, you know, being green about things. Greenhorn, isn't that what they say here? You say here, yeah, greenhorn. So there's all these different greens and different shades of green, deathly green. Green is the colour of fungus and mould, which I particularly like. I love looking at bridge. I used to be a bridge engineer. I used to love the way that the mould and green used to kind of collect around the bridges, especially when they're going to rivers, you know. So there's all lots of different greens, and we're dealing with a situation where we've gone to a situation where it's almost become a cliche and has become absorbed by the system already. So we have to work a bit at that one. Okay, this is another one of my favourite pictures. It's called Searching for the Alchemical Stone. And what I love about it is that the alchemists down here are not... The season is one of the few ways we remind us, hey, it's the season for peas. You see, and you rush out and grab your peas and you're reminded that's it. And that's going, unfortunately. I must admit, though, I do eat frozen peas. Because they're easier, you see, in our lifestyle. And I quite like peas, and so I like to have peas in midwinter. This one is a Van Gogh, and what I love there with his paintings about the peasants is this incredible earthiness. That part of the eating these vegetables and chopping, you know, getting kind of carrots and scrubbing a carrot and chopping it up and so on, is that it brings us back to the earth. It's one of the few ways we have of earthing us, of grounding us. And look at her back. You see peasants like that in Asia now, who are bent from they must spend their whole life looking down, you know. And it's this kind of earthward orientation that I think we get here. Field of cabbages. This is the daughter of the kind of, it's like a peasant, and you know, with a knife. And it's the idea, you know, harvesting the cabbages out there in among the cabbages. I lived once for a while in Adelaide in the hills, in a kind of a little horticultural area, and I was surrounded by cabbage fields. They went on for miles, miles of cabbage fields. And when I went out at night, you could smell the cabbages because they were kind of breathing. And there's this sort of pungent, low smell of the cabbage. And it was quite extraordinary sort of feeling of rootedness, of being earthed. It's a very down sort of smell. This is one that's by an American painter, and it's called Corn Husking Bee at Nantucket Island. It comes from about 1875. What I love about this is you've got all the women. It looks, when it's darker, you can see it. You've got a whole row of women on one side because of the Puritan sort of background, the men on the other. And look at the corn waste. They're up to their knees in this. And what they're doing, of course, they're sitting there, and presumably they're telling stories and bantering between them and telling jokes and singing. I don't know what was the corn. What do they do? But it was obviously a ritual. They couldn't just get it out of a can, and they would use the material for making mats and things and fuel and so this was an extraordinary ritual that had to be done at harvest time. And what I wanted to point out here was the way in which the vegetable is also a very social thing. That it gathers. You know, one only has to think of the kind of multicultural the vegetables in restaurants, and the kind of way in which dealing with harvesting, dealing with the vegetable, is a very communal sort of activity. It's a very social event. This one was simply meant to show the fecundity. I mean, it's an old one, but the woman's breasts and the idea of fertility and the idea of a bounteousness. There are folk stories which warn about this. There was one, and Jung walked and warned about this too, this kind of madness of the vegetable soul. There's one lovely folk story about a young girl who's very poor and goes off into the forest looking for food for herself and her mother. The father's not mentioned, so probably he's dead, or they've been abandoned. And she comes across a good woman in the forest who gives her a pot. And the woman says, look, if you say, little pot, cook, little pot, cook, then you get, it'll just constantly produce porridge, sweet porridge. But then when you say, stop, little pot, stop, it stops. So for years, so she takes this pot back, and for years they have this ample supply of porridge. But one day the girl has to leave the village for a journey for a couple of days, and her mother thinks, oh, this is good. So she says to the pot, cook, little pot, cook. And it starts to produce porridge, but she doesn't know how to stop it. And the porridge comes out, and it fills the house, and it fills the streets, and the whole village is disappearing underneath porridge. And of course, it's only when the girl gets back and says, no, you have to say, stop, little spot. And I think that's quite nice about this. As in the one other story, which was about a princess who couldn't get enough figs. And she said she'll only marry the prince who can supply her with a sufficient number of figs. Well, there are three poor peasants out in the fields, and they hear about this, and the eldest says, oh, okay, I'm going to try this out. So he gets a big basket of figs and goes tromping off to the palace. And an old woman comes up to him and says, on his way, says, you know, excuse me, can you spare me a fig? He says, no, 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 I need all the figs I've got, you know. So off he goes to the palace. And, of course, the princess just kind of eats all the figs and then throws him out. And so the other brother says, okay, I'm going to have two baskets of figs. And he has his basket of figs. Off he goes. And the old woman comes up and says, can I have a fig? And he says, I need all the figs I've got. So he goes off, and the same thing. You know, she just eats the figs in a few minutes and throws him out. And the youngest son, it's always the youngest son, which I like, I'm the youngest son. And the youngest son comes and says, okay, I'm going to do it. So he gets a basket of figs and goes off, and he meets the old woman. The old woman says, please, can you spare me a fig? He says, of course. So he gives her two or three figs. And this is about the generosity of the vegetable world, you see. Because then she says, thank you very much. Look, take this stick, and when you want to fill up the basket, just tap the stick on the ground, which is very Dionysian. If you know Dionysus had a staff, and when he kind of hit the ground, water would flow or vines would grow, you know. So he takes the staff and he goes in with his basket of figs, and of course the princess eats all the figs, and then he taps the ground with his stick,
and the basket fills up again. Oh, so she kind of eats the... And in the end, of course, she keeps doing this, and she just kind of... She ODs on figs, and so she's forced to marry him. So you have to watch it. You have to watch it.
No, thanks.
No, I think it cured her. It cured her of figs. But it's the idea, part of the mythology of the of vegetables is about the peasant and is about generosity as well as the fertility of this. Oh, this is one I really love from Bosch. Instead of, it's the temptation of Eve, and I love that. Instead of the apple, you got this wonderful strawberry, you know. It's like, it's so voluptuous. Isn't it just so juicy? And they can't, and their eyes, look, you know, well, that's it. If I'm going to be tempted, it's got to be more than an apple, you know? This is great. This is terrific, you know. This is part of that kind of primitive, naive painting, but I think it's great, you know. Great. I had no explanation needed. Except his head has disappeared. It's like his head is carrots as well. That's the other thing. It's not just his genitals. This is to remind us of the sacredness of the vegetable. We know all of this all. I mean, bread and wine is part of the sacrament. The body of Christ, if you like, is vegetable. It's bread and wine. This is Van Gogh and his onions, and I think what we start to find with Van Gogh is he actually brings vegetables onto the table. Instead of leaving the onions below, he brings them on, and they become part of, and they're not just there as a kind of an aesthetic, they're part of his everyday world. You know, we've got books, his pipe, and the candle and so on, and there's just these sort of onions, this sense of integrating the vegetable, and I think Van Gogh is wonderful when it comes to integrating that sort of peasant vegetable. Oh, Archimboldo, the whole body becomes a vegetable. The whole face is vegetable and fruit, and the body is made up of wheat sheaves. There's another one here. You can study these. It's a lovely conceit. Can you see the body here? You notice the lie of the knees and the head, looking in the lovely smile of the fig. There's the final one, which is kind of what I hope we'll get into a bit tomorrow. It's about reverie. I do think that unlike dream and vision, reverie is that state of just being in an ambient sort of world. I think reverie is really beautiful. And here's this person in amongst this extraordinary vegetal world and just in a really lovely state of vegetating. I always think, if you can't meditate, vegetate. Okay, yeah, thanks. If you could have the lights on again. In a book by Suskind called Perfume, has anyone read Perfume? It's a really, really great book about smell. Anyway, it's quite dark. But in it, the hero, the protagonist of the book, is abandoned as a child, as a very small, just almost immediately after birth. And this is how the book opens. And is tossed to one side by his mother. He's just abandoned in a marketplace. And the author says, Suskind says, that this little infant, scarcely conscious, made a decision that he was going to live. But he made it in the same way that a bean decides it's going to germinate. And I really think that's a wonderful image of this kind of intelligence, this kind of consciousness at that kind of autonomous level. The idea that the decision is made to germinate. It's an extraordinary image of the deepest levels, I'm getting tripped up on wire here, deepest levels of intelligence and purpose. And Jung wrote about this idea that the vegetable world was the deepest layer of the psyche. And he particularly in some of his work, he didn't talk about the vegetable soul, but he talked about the vegetative nervous system. This is in volume 8. And the vegetable nervous system was, I'm just looking at this here because it's good to see what Jung was saying, it symbolized absolute psychic depth. It was an alien, mysterious, and fundamental region of the psyche. It was kind of uncanny. And when he coined a term called psychoid. I don't know if you're familiar with this. In other words, the psychoid is that mysterious interface between psyche and matter. It's where, if we go deeper and deeper into the psyche, we actually end up, if you like, with bone. We end up with body and matter and substance. And the idea of psychoid level was this extraordinary interface between matter and psyche. And there's a kind of alienness about this. It's very, it's pre-human. And Jung used this a lot in terms of this kind of uncanny depth. This comes up in folk tales too. There's a number of stories that I won't develop, but there's one where a young girl goes out looking for chicory. Again, poor peasant. And she finds a huge chicory plant. It says huge. I don't know how huge the chicory plant is, but I imagine it's sort of this big, you know. And she kind of uproots this chicory plant, and underneath it is it goes down into the ground underneath the chicory plant and finds a whole underground room with dragons. And the story goes about her dealing with the dragons. There's another one of a farmer who comes, a poor farmer. These, a lot of these are Italian ones, who finds a huge mushroom and he hauls the mushroom out. And as he's digging the mushroom out like this, his hands dig out a couple of snakes, vipers. And one of them bites him. And through that, he acquires the magical power to listen to animals. But they say that if he tells anybody this, he'll die. And in another story, there's a young girl who goes out and pulls up a huge cauliflower plant and finds under it this very strange group of cats, very strange cat family. You'd like that one. There's a lot of cats in this one. And another one was again about dragons. So what we find is beneath the vegetable, there are these stories that somehow when we uproot the vegetable, there's this mysterious alien sort of space. And I mean, in terms of developing those, it's great because, you know, the vegetable complex is uprooted and the young girl heroically goes down into the earth on this kind of quest to deal with this level. They're very dangerous places. So getting into the vegetative nervous system is a dangerous and uncanny thing. And I remember one person saying, thank goodness our conscious mind can't interfere with the autonomic nervous system. Can you imagine if we had to make rational decisions every time we wanted our heart to beat or every time we wanted to digest something? You know, I mean, we'd be dead. We just couldn't do it. So thank goodness there's another intelligence. And I often think sometimes when you've been through a kind of psychological crisis, depression or whatever, and you come out the other side, you think, thank God the body's still here. Hello, you know, you've been going. You've still been going all this time. Even though I've been kind of off the planet here and up there and all around here, and you come back to your body and you think some wisdom there has just been steadily going every day, getting you up, taking you asleep, helping you go to the toilet, keeping the heart beating, you know, all those sort of things. And this is the level that that Jung is referring to. And he actually said that the vegetative nervous system produced its own kind of thoughts. It had its own intelligence. Just a couple of quotes from Jung here, because I think they're really great. He said that plant-like growth represents an entirely different psychological experience from that which we are used to. Okay? For we ordinarily think of our psychology in terms of warm-blooded animals, not plants. Yet it is a strange fact that spiritual development is symbolized by plant life. It is the impersonal life of humans, beyond our own psychology. And that kind of life has to follow laws, quite unlike those arising from the mentality of personal, warm-blooded life. So in other words, what he had was an idea that in this region of the psyche, there were another kind of principle at work. And in order to discover that principle, he turned to plants themselves, and he turned to alchemy, to try to understand what kind of consciousness could, if you like, what kind of consciousness could a carrot have? What is our carrot? You know, what is our sort of potato level? And if we dream of them, then you've got to own them, you know. And I think one of the interesting things I found in terms of working with dreams is how the vegetables can often be overlooked. We only have to think of the folk stories in our culture like the Jack and the Beanstalk. We forget that all of that incredible thing was contained in a bean. You know, it was the bean that contained the giant and the world, the fantasy world, or the princess and the pea, or that other one called the pumpkin at the ball, you know, which we call Cinderella. So often we exclude the vegetable and not realizing what a pivotal place. In Hansel and Gretel, at one point they leave dried bread and dried peas to mark their way into the forest so they can then find their way out. Because it's such an uncanny depth that we need the vegetables to help us in and out. But we tend to exclude it. And Jung again stressed the predicament of people in the West as being in exile, as being rootless, and he said that we simply have to be held firm and nourished by our psychological roots. And he said that creative imagination was closely bound up with the taproot of instinct, and that if we lost connection with these deep roots, one was left with a sapless, this is quoting Jung, sapless, almost sad, dusty point of view. So there was that notion that if we'd lost our roots, we would be dry, that we would dry up. We would lose anima, our anima. And in traditional cultures, of course, and again, Paul and I were talking about the Ukraine and so on, in traditional cultures, these spirits, these autonomous complexes, this is what we call them, I prefer to call them vegetable spirits, but we call them autonomous complexes or psychic fragments. They were worshipped as little people, you know, the corn, people in the corn, or little people in the rice harvest, or, as I say, in Inca culture, the potato god, or the Hopi Indians worshipping the god of the corn, the maize crop, and so on. So in Jung's work, we actually find two angles. There's the idea of kundalini, of reaching upwards. There's the idea of reaching to the unfathomable transcendence. And there's the idea of vegetables reaching down into this uncanny kind of depth. And it's this kind of movement that I really wanted to bring out. Just to finish, there's a couple of stories. One is a dream about a 35-year-old man, I said he's a young man, but that just shows up my age, 35-year-old man dreams he's in some mountains and there's a new hotel construction going on. And there's a deep crater filled with water. And there's this development going on of a hotel complex. And the water level starts to go down and he starts to worry, hang on a minute, is there enough water? Because this water was supposed to provide the hotel with water as well as building it. Is there enough water to sustain the development? And I can't help thinking that when you look at the metaphors in, for example, in Freud, one of his metaphors of psychological development was draining the marshlands around Rome. You know, the unconscious was thought of as marsh. So the ego drains the marshland. Another one was the Zuider Zee. Do you know the Zuider Zee? It was a, for those who don't, it was in Holland, it was an area of ocean that was reclaimed to land, and then you could build on it. And it seemed to me we wouldn't allow that nowadays. If we're going to drain the swamps out here, we'd have environmentalists saying, hang on, that's a unique habitat. You see what I mean? And we wouldn't just want to... Because the thing, and what I wanted to stress is that is the language of psychology, much of the language of psychological development, echoes the idea of industrial development. The idea of we want to live a productive life, we want to be mobile. There's a lot of this sort of metaphor. And I kind of think we need to also have the image of the deep ecologist saying, hang on a minute, is this development sustainable? Have we got the reserves in our psyche to support it? Or will this development kill some of the fauna and flora in our psyche? Do we need these? Like in Australia now, there's a big campaign to protect the shark. Well, White Point of sharks, I mean, since I've been there, I've eaten quite a few humans. Just you see them in summer swimming along the coast. And yet they're an endangered species. So there's this idea of we need sharks. So we actually need these creatures in our psyche. So I actually think we have to start looking with the eye of an environmentalist, just to check up whether or not we want to get rid of the swamps, draining the bogs. Even our term bogged is bad. You know, we talk about getting bogged and it's boggy. Well, in Britain, or Scotland particularly, there's the Bog Preservation Society because these are a unique habitat. The sphagnum moss is hundreds of years old and it breathes and floats and it extends. Well, in Ireland, they've actually got bog-fueled power stations because they dig up the peat bog and put it in and they're burning it. They're dying out. There's virtually none left. So this is a very unique habitat. So even our language of being bogged down, maybe we need to be bogged down. You know, maybe, you know, we no longer call jungle jungle, it's called rainforest. We no longer call swamps swamps because otherwise we get swamped with things, you know, and it's kind of, we call them mangroves. So we change our, we need to sort of change our sort of language with regard to some of the things that we feel unpleasant and maybe see it more ecologically. And just to finish with a story, because I think it's a fun story, it's a folk tale from Italy, and there's this very poor Italian peasant. It's always the poor Italian peasant who's sitting there. Is Don Giovanni, his name. I can tell you his full name. Don Giovanni Miseranti. I don't know if it means miserable, Don, but Don Giovanni. Okay, he's sitting there. He doesn't know what to do. He's desperately poor, and suddenly he sees a bean, one bean, so big, lying on the ground. And he's, great. So he picks up this bean and thinks, I can plant this bean. And if I water it and look after it carefully, I'll get a bean plant. And there'll be lots of seed pods. And I'll dry the seed pods, and then I'll be able to plant them in a bowl, and I'll get a lot more plants and seed pods. Then what I'll do, if I keep this going, is I'll rent a small garden. And I'll plant all these bean seeds, and I'll grow lots of beans. And then maybe in about 3 years' time, I'll rent lots of warehouses or storehouses where I can keep all of these beans, and I'll get really rich. So he had this sort of fantasy. This is all looking at one bean. And he had this fantasy. So he goes off down the road, and he sees a friend, and he borrows a nice suit of clothes from his friend. And then he sets out to negotiate, because he's playing out the fantasy, to negotiate renting a whole street of warehouses for his beans. Okay, and he puts the bean in his pocket, and he goes up to these rich people, a rich family who own all these warehouses, and he says, look, I want to rent all of these warehouses. And they think, this man must have a lot of money. And he gets talking to them and everything. And in the end, of course, he proposes to the daughter. And they think, of course you can marry her. You know, you're so wealthy. So he marries the daughter, and he gets a dowry, and he spends all the money and everything. Of course, there comes a time when the in-laws want to see his property. Where are all his bean fields? And you think, uh-oh, I'm sunk. So he gets on his horse and rides out in front of the carriage. He puts his in-laws, his wife and the father and the mother in a carriage, and they ride out across. And he rides out in front, and he says, all those fields as far as you can see to the left are mine. And making it up, of course. All those fields to the right are mine. And as he goes, he's bribing the farmers to tell them, yeah. He says, look, when these people come along and says, does Don Giovanni own these? Tell them yes, you know, so he gives them some things. So he keeps riding, and they're going on for hours like this. Well, of course, they want to see his home. So in the end, he rides and rides. He comes to a place where there's nothing. He thinks, that's it. I'm done for. And at that moment, he's waiting for the horse and the carriage to catch up. He sees a palace in the distance. And in the palace, at the window, is a beautiful young woman dressed in green. And she's beckoning him over like this. He sort of kind of rides his horse over and goes in. And she comes down and meets him and says, this is all yours. This is your palace. I'm giving it to you. She says, I'm the bean. I'm the bean that you picked up and looked after. You see, and I kind of think, isn't that great? All this was contained in the bean. It was like this was the anima, you know? You know the way the knights and warriors always have the handkerchief from the woman? Well, he had a bean, and he recognized that in the heart of this bean, rather like Jack and the Beanstalk, was contained this incredible world, and I just think that's a marvelous image of the power and vitality of the vegetable soul. Okay, thank you. Okay, here we can start, yeah.
A real bummer, folks, and none of us like it, is they need us to kind of leave quickly. They're coming after us about that. So
okay.
Let's all try to bear with that as best as we can. So we're going to, even though I'm sure we could sit here and just talk till 10, we're going to need to sort of start at 9:30, you know, maybe some conversations.
Okay. All right, okay, great.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is the idea about the portability of place with the carpet as mm-hmm. metaphor. And it seems to me that I've tried to now place
yes.
myself, but it's the animal. For one thing, it can never be like I grew up because like we were talking about in terms of the sensory connection as a child.
Mm.
But suddenly, until you slow down and see rhythms occur over months and several years, you know, Gary Snyder said you have to live somewhere 100 years and then you might be able to move to visit somewhere else. I don't see how we can have place be portable.
Yeah, the portability. I don't know if people heard that. The portability of place. How can we, when we are mobile, how can we put down roots? Jung reckoned that his roots were shallow because his ancestors had only been living there for a couple of thousand years. So, I mean, it's relative. I think maybe the nomads, you know, we can think of nomads. I mean, it depends on the kind of movement one does. I mean, the thing about nomads is that they don't just wander anywhere. They go specifically and they visit the same places periodically. You know, they have a very definite path. I think we're caught with two things here. I think on one hand, we have to be able to do it. That's the first. You know, I mean, most people here, roots are not very deep in this soil. And Jung warned about, when he was analysing America, the psychology of America. I don't know if you know that bit. He said that the problem is that the American culture sits on the surface. Goodness knows what he said about Australian culture, but it sits on the surface, and that it's very hard for it to accommodate shadow because of that, because it doesn't have the depth. So it's quite an interesting essay to read on that. I think it's in Mind and Earth. He's got two vegetable essays, Jung. One's called Mind and Earth, and the other one's The Philosophical Tree. Mind and Earth is about having roots, and the tree is about growth. You know. So we have to do it. I mean, one of the problems with living in the postmodern age is that most people do have many homes. I mean, you know, I've got a home in England, but I don't live there. But, you know, migrants, remember, you know, Paul, you were talking about your home in the Ukraine. You know, we have home which is, we have third-generation Australians still calling England home. You know, and the children. So we do live with, I think we have to accommodate. And I think this comes into Jung's notion of the fragmented psyche, the pluralistic psyche. I noticed you've got Andrew Samuels' book. The pluralistic psyche, that we have to identify all the different characters that we are. You know, we're not just a whole. Me standing here is a different character than when I'm with my three-year-old, you know, and I have different characters. And each of those characters has a different kind of relationship to a different kind of home. Do you see what I mean? And I think the literal earthy one is it belongs to one particular character, and I think that could be seen as, say, the Great Mother, perhaps. And I think that part of us is wounded. And I don't see any way our culture in the short term, it's not possible in the short term to heal that and to get those kind of roots. But the other parts of us, Hermes, is quite at home, moving all the time. And I think it's the rituals that we use. And I think the rituals of eating, of rituals of shelling peas, and the rituals of paying homage to Hestia, you know, the kitchen area. I read one statistic, which is that most American families don't eat breakfast together. That was the... And I think, well, we can... I don't know if it's true or not. We hear funny things out in the outside world. But it seems to me that there are certain kind of rituals. So it's that, it's about slowing down, it's about taking in things. It's that kind of work. We have to almost... So I think the first one is identifying all these different characters. And if we've got a strong Hermes part, well, maybe Hermes is quite happy sitting in front of the computer, you know, and that's home. I mean, maybe Aphrodite has a different thing. So it's the different characters. I think it's the only way of thinking about it, you know. Does that make sort of sense, or...? Culturally. Well, yeah.
You're talking about the nomads relating to the land.
Yes.
On a basis. Many Native American tribes themselves went to various places during different seasons.
Yeah.
So I think there is maybe what you're concerned about is, you know, long periods of disconnection. But I think there is, not just eat seasonally, but relate to the
land seasonally and move seasonally, yeah. I think it's like the Neolithic Revolution, as you know, was a catastrophe, is seen by that way in some. The Neolithic Revolution was when humans who had been hunter-gatherers for most of our life, we've been hunter-gatherers, depends how deep the roots you want, but through the Ice Age, most of the human population of the world lived prior to the Neolithic Revolution. That is, when you look at the population statistics, it's such an immense period of time, say 2 million years, that most of the dead were Stone Age. It's kind of interesting. I was playing around with the idea of at what point do the living outnumber the dead? Well, it will never happen because the immense history of Ice Age humans meant that the men... Now, in that time, everyone were hunter-gatherers. And the Neolithic Revolution is when we tamed wild grasses and turned them into wheat. And then when humans tamed... And then had gardens. And a lot of people think that was when the catastrophe started. So in a sense, you might want to argue that we have to get back into a more kind of nomadic way where we have to have rituals that create the place for us when we arrive. You know, we have our things, we have our carpet, we have our psychological carpet we bring with us, and we try to be sensitive to the place we're at. And we try not to be too mobile, but within that mobility, we just maybe try to learn more from the nomads rather than the settled horticultural civilization. So maybe we need to get to those myths, you know, those sort of stories. It's just a thought, or else we're going down the sink, you know. I like to be optimistic. Yeah?
I'd like to share a client's story. So it's old living. She was dreaming that there was a cabbage head peeking in the window of her high school.
Oh, yes. That's great. That's... Well, I mean, it's like the kind of the... It's all in the head, in the school. You know, all the learning is rational and up in the head. And it's like the poor old cabbage is outside, you know, knocking at the window. Let me in. I want to come. I want to be there.
It had eyes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. Definitely. I want to. I want the cabbage to come in, and which relates to the idea of teaching relaxation, meditational sort of skills, teaching about listening to the body, listening to the environment. These sort of things can be taught in schools. Sorry, there was one over here. Was it just Kate? Was there a question? No. Back, sorry.
When you went to the north of Scotland,
yes.
Did you go to Findhorn?
No, that was on the... I know about Findhorn, yeah. It's on the east coast. I was on the west coast. But, yeah, well, there they actually use vegetable spirits, you know, devas, and they've grown vegetables where people thought they were impossible to grow. Really beautiful species. You know Findhorn? It's a kind of... It's a centre, healing... alternative community. So no, I really wanted to get to Findhorn, but I just didn't make it. I can get very immobile when I get to places. I move a lot, but when I'm there, I stop, you know. Yes, please. Yeah, yeah.
The only thing I'd ask you about is the role of leaving.
Leaving, yes. Yes.
And I wonder if people who have never left have the connectedness in a way that works. Yes.
Well, they do. I mean, I'm sure that, I mean, a culture that's basically been living on the same plot of land for 40,000 years has an immeasurable connection with that place. I mean, we have roots that are just as old. It's just that ours go trailing back across continents, you know. I mean, everyone has roots. I mean, our roots go back just as ancient as anybody else's, but they've not stayed in the same place. Our ancestors had the kind of itchy foot and kept moving. I mean, I'm sure the Aboriginals would if they could have, but they kind of ended up in Australia, and the land bridge between Australia and Asia vanished under the ocean. There wasn't anywhere else to go, you know. So they kind of stuck there. But our lot kept moving and moving and moving. So we've developed a very rich source of wisdom about moving. I mean, I kind of feel that the rituals of leaving and the rituals of being... I mean, it's interesting, but it does have a shadow side to it. And I think it's interesting that if you take, say, Athens, I mean, and the culture of Athens, that when you look at the mythology of the founding of Athens, it's very different to Rome. The Athenians believed that they weren't settlers. Their mythology says that they actually sprang out of the ground. Do you remember the story about sowing the dragon's teeth? And then out of the dragon's teeth in the ground sprang warriors. And those warriors fought with each other, and the survivors were the Athenians. So they weren't settlers. You know, it's an incredible story about a kind of autochthonic existence. They didn't come from anywhere else. And I kind of feel, we know they did, of course. But the thing there is the importance of actually having these stories that say we come from here. We didn't come from anywhere else. And I think there's part of us, there's a part of me, even though I've only been in Australia 25 years, that feels that's where I came from. You know, I mean, another part knows it's not true.
And you think we kind of romanticize the plant kingdom to some extent and look at the rootedness aspect, but I can imagine a little dandelion mother plant, if we were in the personifier, saying, oh, all the children, they've flown away.
You know? But that's right. Yeah, sure, sure.
You know, some plants may be more so than others, but the other plants do.
Yes, they do. There's an immobility. Yes.
They
have to. All plants have to have a way of being mobile. I mean, the old plants, the ancient plants, were fir trees, like you've got here. And the way they propagated was to explode and fire their seeds out. And it's only with the flowering plants that they then need the insects. I mean, some are carried by wind, but mostly it's carried by birds or by insects who brush against. And that's the way. So plants do need mobility too. And I think that it's the way Jung says that we need to recover the unconscious but without losing the level of consciousness that we've got. And I can't help thinking that the challenge that we have is to hold on to the level of rationality, to deepen it of course as well, but to sustain that and to sustain the level of instinctual animal life, but at the same time to begin to do our respects to the vegetal world. But you need all three. Otherwise, we will be just plants. You know?
Yes. The strawberry plant has an umbilical cord.
Does it?
Sure.
Oh, of course, it shoots out. Yeah, yeah.
The new plant grows.
Yeah.
The old.
That's beautiful. So they just kind of creep along like this.
So they don't go far back.
Mm.
Like the kind of world.
Well, there's also, I mean, the plant world is a fantastic world. I mean, it's There's those plants that trees whose roots are in the air. You know the kind of banyan trees, I think they are, and the roots are in India. You see them. The roots are just in the atmosphere because it's so moist they can absorb all the. So they're not actually. Some roots are in the ground for the trunk, but the rest just hang. So you don't actually have to think about the literal. And there's another wonderful, wonderful plant that flowers. It takes something like 200 years to flower, and it flowers once. And then dies. I think, isn't that great? Isn't that a fantastic image?
What does it do with the
strawberry here? Just vegetates, getting bigger and.
Psychologically, what is it?
Well, in Australia, there are these. They're not cactus, they're arid plants. They look like cactus, but they're kind of crunchy, they're not spiky. Kind of grow up, and they grow about so much every year. So when you see one that high, you're looking at a very old sort of plant. They just go little by little. So there's a patience there too, I think, in plants. Yeah, I know. I'm aware of the time. Okay, thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.